Hi, good evening, and welcome to another episode of the Jewish People Policy Institute's Inside Analysis of Israel's War Against Hamas. To our viewers and listeners from the United States, welcome back from your Thanksgiving holiday weekend. I hope it was restful and enjoyable. Here in Israel, we're not exactly on a holiday weekend, but a bit of a lull or pause, I guess you could call it, in the war for the exchange of hostages, although every day seems to bring with it more psychological warfare, more tension, and more challenges in understanding, as well as dilemmas of what's next, where is this all going, how many hostages this day, how many hostages the next day, and what will happen when we're 2-3 days down the road into the extension of the ceasefires. It seems that everybody's looking to extend it. And suddenly Hamas says, we're only going to give Israel 4. Does Israel continue to extend, or does Israel decide to go back to the offensive? And I think those are just some of the questions I'd like to talk later with our two panelists. We're joined by Einat Wilf, a former member of Knesset, former senior fellow at JPPI and acclaimed author, as well as with Professor Yonatan Givati, who's a senior fellow at JPPI, a professor of law and economics at the Hebrew University of Jerusalem. But before we get started, I did an interview late last night with Abe Foxman, the legendary leader and head national director of the ADL, the Anti-Defamation League. Spoke to Abe about America's role in this conflict. He referred to President Biden's existence, or the role that he's been playing in this war, as nothing short of a miracle, as well as obviously we spoke about the explosion of anti-Semitism and what does it mean for the future of Jews and the fear that maybe Jews will be afraid to be Jewish. So here's the interview with Abe Foxman, and then we will go to our panel with Einat and Yonatan. Abe Foxman, thank you so much for joining us at JPPI. We appreciate your time. So there is a lot obviously going on and a lot to talk about. I want to start with you with the hostage release, which is very much on our minds and in the headlines. And America has been playing a very important role. You were just telling me how you heard the president speak after the release of Avigail Idan, the 4-year-old American Israeli girl whose parents were murdered on October 7th. And she now has been released to Israel, to her grandparents and to her siblings. What do you make of President Biden and the role that he's played throughout this war so far?
I would say it's a miracle, because I think America and probably Israel and the world had written President Biden off 6 months ago, saying he doesn't have it, he's not there, he's lost it, he shouldn't run, whatever. And then tragedy hit Israel and the Jewish people. And this president of the United States stood up like a lion in defense of Israel. He embraced it, he supported it, continues to be involved. So thank God for him, thank God for America. Israel has two allies, it's the Jewish people in America, and the president is leading America at the moment. It isn't over, it isn't finished. There's still issues of aid, there's still issues of continuing the war. But for the moment, in the last 50 days, thank God for Joe Biden as president of the United States. And that's whether you're a Democrat or a Republican.
But do you see that staying the course in that way? I mean, we're hearing a lot more voices now within the Democratic Party who are calling for this temporary ceasefire to turn into a permanent ceasefire. We're hearing a lot more of the progressive flank of the Democratic Party, which is pushing, there are people calling him Genocide Joe, right, because of his support here for Israel. Can the president stick with Israel, especially as the election cycle is going to heat up now with ahead of the next November's presidential election?
Yeah, I think so. I think because I don't think he's a classic politician. I think he's got a moral compass. I think when he embraced Israel, he basically said very clearly, the America of today is not the America of the time of the Holocaust, when America wasn't there. And he said, we will be there. Listen, before October 7th, he said, Israel makes every Jew feel safe. That's as Zionist a statement as you can make. Well, October 7th, not every Jew felt safe, and afterwards, and yet he's still there. So I'm not worried. I think he will continue to stand up. Listen, America is changing. America is changing. Recently, one of your leaders asked me, how would you assess America? And I would say, this is probably the last administration which will be as friendly to Israel as you can imagine, because there is a new generation. You have a new generation of Democrats who do not know Joseph. They do not know history. They don't understand history. They don't remember the Holocaust. They don't understand it. They don't know 48, 67, 73. All of this is ancient history for them, or totally ignorant. All of these things were elements that kept the American people close to Israel. You have a Republican government, and a Republican Party, which is isolationist, continues to be isolationist. You have the evangelicals, who are the new generation of evangelicals, don't necessarily believe that they need Israel to have the second coming. And the Jews have been really mistreated by Israel throughout these years. So put all these elements together, and this is probably the last generation of strong support. It doesn't mean that in the future won't be there, but Israel and the Jewish people are going to have to work at it.
You know, as we talk, Abe, there is an explosion of anti-Semitism, right? I think it was the organization that you headed for nearly 30 years, the ADL, just reported a couple weeks ago, 400% increase in anti-Semitism in the United States. We've been watching what's been happening on college campuses, where it's particularly disturbing, places like Cornell, Columbia, Penn, and others, Harvard, of course, but also just around the world. I mean, England, London is looks like it's been taken over by an Islamic mob. France, Jews are taking mezuzahs off their front doors and are seeing Magen David spray painted on Jewish businesses. And, you know, you were a child Holocaust survivor. I remember the story of, you know, of course, of how you were your parents put you into a Catholic monastery of sorts.
It was a nanny.
And you were, you know, came to collect you, thankfully, after the war. What do you make of this, and what can be done?
Well, I think the question people are asking me today, are you surprised? And my answer is no, I'm not surprised, but I am shocked. I'm not surprised because for the 50 years that I was in the ADL, we were delivering a message which nobody listened to, nobody wanted to listen to, maybe because it wasn't comfortable. And we were saying, I remember in all the roles that I had at the ADL, and every year we issued reports, we said anti-Semitism is serious. Certainly serious in the world, but we said it was serious in the United States. What America is unique, but not immune. Not immune from anti-Semitism. It's a racist country in many respects. It's fought, you know, civil war about on racism. But we had in the last 50 years developed a strategy of containment, which worked. When you think of it, when you think about America in the last 100 years, from the lynching of Leo Frank in 1913 to the murder of 11 Jews in Pittsburgh, 100 years, only 3 Jews died in America because they were Jews. 2 of them related to the Middle East, which was Mayor Kahana and David Halberstam, and one was the Brooklyn Crown Heights pogrom. But for 100 years, so it was unique. We it wasn't guaranteed, but we always said it's there. 30% of the American people still believe we killed Christ. 30% of the American people still believe that we're too powerful and too controlling in business and in government, et cetera. So it was all there. So it's not surprised that when you took the lid off the sewers, when the internet provided a super highway for unfettered anti-Semitism and race and hate. Not surprised when, whether you like Trump or not, he did good things. He also did bad things. He removed all taboos. And when the taboos were off, we're number one on the hit parade. And He didn't create the 200 neo-Nazis in Charlottesville, but he gave them a hechsher, that it was okay for them. So we're experiencing lack of civility, and lack of civility permits all, and probably the most significant thing that has happened in the last 5-10 years, and again, I blame it on Trump and Trumpism, he's destroyed truth. Truth was our defense. What is anti-Semitism? It's the big lie. How do you answer the big lie with truth? Well, he destroyed truth. And when we don't have truth as a weapon, as a vehicle to defend it, it comes to where it is today. So I'm not surprised, but I am shocked. I'm shocked in the sense that the intensity of the hate that's there. That means I knew it was always there. But to see it as cruel, as ugly, and as vehement, and as intense, I think that is shocking. The other thing that's shocking is we were a part of Yaakov, the effort to develop a strategy was to embrace other groups. But we never were fooled that they're going to stand up for us and defend us and fight for us. I don't think anybody, people may have thought, but most of us understood, it's part of our tradition. And I'm only for myself, what am I? So we understood it's part of not only justice and civility, but it's justice and civility for us. But we never thought they're going to come to the ramparts and defend us. But my God, such silence, such apathy, such indifference. Yeah, you know, you can count on the fingers of your hands the people that we embraced that stood up. So that's shocking. That's very shocking. And again, go back to where we started. Thank God for America. And thank God for the president.
But you know, you mentioned obviously the other groups. You know, the outreach that was done to different communities and people who just aren't there, politicians who are silent, people who are drawing the moral equivalency that just makes. Is so abhorrent in this conflict. But what I'm worried about is when I look at other Jews around the world, and particularly those in the United States, and I fear that what's happening now, because you can't escape Israel, right? If you're Jewish, if you have a name like Foxman or a name like Katz, and you're living in, you know, somewhere in the middle of Arkansas, they're coming at you because you just have a Jewish name. And for whatever Israel did, it makes no difference whether you support it or you don't support it. What this could lead to is more Jews who want to move away from Judaism, who want to hide their Judaism, who don't want to be proud Jews. Are you afraid of that happening, of that being a counter effect of this?
Yeah, I'm worried. I've always been worried. Listen, we've lived through Jews change their names, their identities, their noses, etc. So we've lived through this. You know, some of the great Jews of today in their memoirs tell us that when people thought that their name was German, they would say it's German. You know, so today they're great Jewish heroes. So it runs in phases. I do worry, because if one Jew takes off the mezuzah, it's one too many. But on the other hand, I think what you're seeing in Israel, and here Israel suffered a trauma, an unbelievable trauma, okay? And look how quickly everybody came together. Look how quickly those who were opposed to the government and against the government, within 24 hours, united. I was in Washington at the rally. You know, I was the last rally that made me feel proud as a Jew was the Soviet Jewry rally. But, you know, they came from everywhere. They came from all walks of Jewish life, the left and the right, the religious and the non-religious. So at the end of the day, I continue to be an optimist. A couple of years ago, I was invited to a seminar at the White Plantation on the subject, will Jewish civilization survive the year 2050? And what they did is they had some researchers study the historians of history, the Toynbees, the Spenglers, to see if they can distill why the Roman Empire disappeared, the Greek Empire disappeared, the Incas, which we're not sure, but they did, and why did Jewish civilization survive? And if we can distill what it was that kept Jews going, then we can answer the question, will we survive 2025? And what they came up with is something, you know, almost very simple, but yet very, very important. They said after the Roman Empire fell, no Roman got up and said, I want to be a Roman. When the Greeks lost their empire, Greeks didn't run around saying, I want to be a Greek. And if after the Shoah, when Jews got up and said, I want to be a Jew, I want to rebuild as a Jew, I want to raise my kids as a Jew, that's the secret of Jewish survival. And I believe, yeah, time, we've had tough times, and these are tough times. But, you know, I'm seeing Jews stopping aid to universities. I'm seeing employers saying we're not going to hire anti-Semites. I'm seeing Jews standing up as Jews who I've never seen stand up as Jews. So yeah, it hurts for every Jew that takes off a Magen David or removes a mezuzah, because that gives an anti-Semite a victory. But on the whole, I believe the Jewish people, and you see it in Israel, and I'm seeing it here. I've been going to synagogues, and I'm seeing people are coming to synagogues. I've been to synagogues in the last 10 years because, you know, they want to be part of the Jewish people. And being part of the Jewish people is being part of Israel.
Abe, on that optimistic and positive note, I'm going to say thank you so much for being with us. Thanks for everything that you've been doing also all your life for the Jewish people. So thank you very much. So that was Abe Foxman. Always interesting to hear his perspective, especially on the issue of anti-Semitism and everything that's happening there. And I figured that that's where we'd start. And Yonatan, maybe we'll start with you. You spent a lot of time, obviously, in the United States, teaching, working, and as an educator in Jewish communities and campuses. I mean, what's happening all over there? There's been some steps that have been taken. We saw, for example, the Harvard president established this kind of committee that's aimed at tackling anti-Semitism and writing a new charter for how the school will do or what it will do in cases like this. But I don't know that overall the situation is that much better. I mean, what's your read of what's happening?
Yes, so it's difficult to know actually long term where things will end, but it seems that like there is some reaction within the academic world to what was happening. I've been in touch with people at Columbia as well, and I think they established a similar board to counter anti-Semitism. I think there are deep cultural trends here that are manifested in the university, and it's a big question. It's hard to know where things are going, I think, especially given the fact that things happened so recently. I think overall, what I think the current events have revealed is that there was, I guess, for some time, an argument that was made towards Israel that if Israel is just more just, things will be better for the Jews in the United States. And I think what we realized is that when Israel is weak, the Jews are weak in the United States as well. So it's not so much this idea. There was the idea that there's this trade-off. If Israel is willing, would take more risks and would be just more just, people will feel more comfortable. Jews will feel more comfortable in their home countries. And this didn't happen here. The demonstrations against Israel and the anti-Semitic events started before Israel was even invaded Gaza this time. So I think what was revealed is what actually we saw also in 1967, when Israel wins, when Israel is strong, I think Jews are proud and just feel more confident. And even when we're just, it doesn't help. When you're weak, even if you're just, I think people see the weakness and they come at you.
So you're obviously watching very carefully everything that's been going on in the U.S. You were there just a few weeks ago, speaking at a bunch of different places and meeting with people. I mean, you know, I think that one of the issues that I guess American Jews are going to have to grapple with much more is what is the future of the education, the higher education system? Where are their kids going to go to school? My son has joked, he's 11, so take this all with a grain of salt, has said since he's been a little kid, because he was born in the year that I did a fellowship at Harvard, so he's always been speaking about how he wants to go to Harvard one day, but he said to me even the other day, and again, he's 11, he said, Abba, I don't know if I can go to Harvard anymore because everything that's been going on there beats me where he's read or heard about it, but I'm guessing some Instagram post somewhere. I mean, what is going to happen forward-looking?
So first of all, I have to say on that specific front, I went to Harvard as an undergraduate in the early 90s. I think at the time there were at least one-fifth or one-fourth of the student body were Jews. Today, I think it's back to around 10% under the classic 10%. And to understand in retrospect that this was not the wave of the future. You know, when we were there in the 90s, the feeling was that this is normal. This is it. That, like, Jews have arrived. I mean, I came there as an Israeli, but it was clear that there was substantial Jewish presence. And in retrospect, we now understand that it was a moment rather than the new normal. So I think there will be grappling with that, with the notion that things are unidirectional, but rather understand that, you know, we made assumptions about things moving in a certain direction, and they've been reversed, and they could be even reversed some more.
Reversed in a sense, what do you mean by that? Like, how would that manifest? How much worse could it get?
You could get how much below 10% you could have. You could have
saying the numbers.
The numbers, because you're seeing it now. You're seeing more and more families. I mean, I started seeing it years ago when families were telling me quietly that as they're applying for colleges, their children are looking at the campus environment, and especially kind of the anti-Zionism and how much the pro-Palestinian but really anti-Jewish activity is on campus. But now it's much more in the open. I mean, now you know you have families, prospective students saying, you know, this is a major consideration. On the very selfish side, a part of me says, okay, great, come to Israeli universities. You know, there's a kind of this hope for a wave of many Jews from around the world coming to study in Israeli academia. I think that could be a wonderful boost. But yeah, there's a sense of dread. There's a sense of premonition. The question of we're seeing the numbers, we're projecting the attitudes, what it means a generation from now. If I'll share with you something, many years ago, I gave a talk to a group of African-American leaders who came to Israel. And I told them the story of the Jewish people in Israel. And one of the women said, you know, I'm listening to you and I'm thinking, your story is our story, the story of the Jewish people, the story of Black people, African-Americans. It's the same story, she said. And then she went, but, you know, I go home to my home in Brooklyn and I have a Jewish neighbor and they don't look like they're suffering. They have a beautiful house. They have a lovely art collection. They don't look like they're suffering. And I told her, let me give you an insight into the Jewish psyche. I told her, your neighbor might have a beautiful art collection and a lovely house, but deep inside, he knows that it could all turn on a dime. And I think there, this is the concern now, the sense that it could all turn on a dime. And the understanding that we cannot just be passive watchers of this process, but actually need to actively battle against it.
Yeah. Very interesting. You know, one of the things that's happening, we're already on the topic of anti-Semitism, then I do have to bring up Elon Musk's visit to Israel today. I think I actually saw him as I was coming back into the city from Tel Aviv. There was a convoy of like these Cadillac Escalades, which you don't usually see in the city of Jerusalem, driving through near the president's house. And I know he just met with the president. I'm guessing it might have been him. But either way, Elon Musk has come under severe, harsh criticism for endorsing an anti-Semitic post on X or Twitter, whatever it's called these days. And someone who was talking about Jews hate for white people. And then he said, yeah, you said it, you know, I 100% agree with you, but also just how X/Twitter. And I'm on it. I mean, you know, I know you're not. You're very active on it. Yonatan, I don't know how active you are on it, but you know, you're following it. It's a cesspool of anti-Semitism, of Jew hatred, of just anything bad in this world. You'll find it on Twitter. Still, we're all there. And he comes here for this 24-hour visit. Netanyahu takes him down to one of the kibbutzim in the south. He meets with the president, meets with Benny Gantz, is shepherded around like a hero. You know, Yonatan, I mean, is there not a line that Israel needs to draw in the sand and say, By the way, I mean, there was a guy, sorry, I just had one other element to it, Michael Freund, who's a longtime right-wing activist from Renana, and used to be an aide to the prime minister, pointed out that Nasrallah runs an English profile page on X, right? Hassan Nasrallah, the leader of Hezbollah, terrorist organization. Why is Israel and our leadership playing ball with Elon Musk?
Yeah, I guess the big question is how much can Israel influence the rules of the game, or how much Israel takes the rules of the game as given and tries to do the best it can within the rules of the game. So I think it's a trade-off Israel is facing also, I guess, when it's part of international organizations that shockingly did not express any condemnations of the events. So do you try to say, okay, this is a disaster, we're leaving everything, we're trying to do our own thing? Or do you try to have some impact within the rules? I think within the Elon Musk situation, it's really this is clearly someone who could influence the rules. So what is the best way for him, for us to get to make an impact on him? One way is to say, okay, no one shun him. The other way is actually try to convince him. And I can't personally, I'm not totally sure what is the right policy here. This is something we could only look at in retrospect and see which policy would have been right, but it's not obvious to me what the right decision would have been here.
And by the way, on that point, to President Herzog's credit, he did bring up exactly that issue with Elon Musk, which I didn't see Netanyahu necessarily bring up, but Herzog did bring it up and say that it's full of hate, it's full of hatred, it's full of anti-Semitism. And Elon Musk made some comments about how it is, and we have to do more to hate to stop this hate, et cetera. But Inat, I'm guessing that you would have a more political read of the Netanyahu embrace, remembering that when Netanyahu flew to the UN General Assembly, and someone reminded me of this today because I'd almost forgotten, Elon Musk had been in New York on Sunday meeting Turkish President Erdogan, flew back to San Francisco. Netanyahu was leaving Israel, flew all the way to San Francisco, as opposed to having Musk spend one more day in New York, because Netanyahu only spent the day in San Francisco to meet Elon. What do you make of it?
I'm deeply uneasy with the whole situation on so many levels. At the time, what he did in San Francisco and New York was basically because he was trying in some bizarre maneuver to show that he's kind of circumventing President Biden, because President Biden was giving him a lot of trouble with the judicial issues, and rightfully so. And so he wanted to show that he's going to the person who's more powerful than the American president. I don't like these games. I don't think they're healthy. Like you said, it also comes with a price of just ignoring issues. Elon Musk is an erratic man. I'm not sure it's wise to play to this erraticism. I'm deeply uneasy. Also, we know that Netanyahu looks to social media to buttress his support. So that also feels uneasy. I don't like it.
So I do want to talk for just one moment about Netanyahu, because I do think that it's interesting. We have two people who are coming from different sides for a moment of the spectrum, Einat and Yonatan. Netanyahu, obviously, we all know, has yet to take responsibility for what happened on October 7th. My read of it, and it's been pretty much confirmed to me by people who have met with him, is it stems from two reasons. Number one, he doesn't think he's responsible, right, which is pretty obvious. Number two is he sees a day after for himself here, right? So he believes that he can continue to remain in office when this is all over. Personally, I have a lot of problems with that, but I put that aside for one moment. The question is, right now, Israel's facing a huge dilemma, Yonatan, with the hostages, right? Because as the deal and the extension of the ceasefire goes forward, it's going to be, at what point does Israel relaunch the offensive? And at what point does Israel say that it's going to have to go back up against the public? Because to relaunch the offensive might be at the expense of getting two or three hostages, because Hamas could start to play games, like I said in the beginning, and say, okay, on Thursday, I can only find three, But if you extend another day, I'll give you those three. So do you do it or do you not do it? And the public wants those three home, presumably. But the national interest might, there's going to come a point that Israel's going to have to say enough already. We have to go back into Gaza. How do you see Netanyahu managing this?
Well, I think in some sense, Netanyahu is a reflection of the fact that it's hard to predict what he's going to do, but I do think that the real cause of the issue is the need for the Israeli public to mature in a sense and to stop thinking. And this is a very difficult decision to make. And I think Yedidya Stern actually had a column about this morning in Israeli newspapers. And this idea that we think about the hostages as our children, and I think we all feel very passionate about them. But I think as public, we have to think about the long term. And I think the media is is partly responsible, I think, for creating.
The media is totally pushing the hostages at every.
What do you think about this?
It's obviously something that we all care for, right? And we all want. But you can tell how in the stories, in the language, in what's being said, how much it is, that is the priority. No longer Hamas. Sorry to interrupt.
No, I totally agree with everything. And I think it's also more sensational in a sense because there's a human story about it and it's a very sad story. There's some redemption that we're seeing. So I do think that it's very attractive from a journalistic perspective, but I don't think that long-term it's very helpful. But you can think you're talking about Twitter, I guess. But the incentives of journalists are often to create something more sensational. Like the idea that the newspaper would say, I'm going to put the pictures of the hostages in the back pages because we have to think about long term. I just don't see an editor doing it. But maybe you could tell me what you think about this. If you were an editor of Jerusalem Post today, what would you have done differently?
By the way, Yedidya Stern's column, which was published in Yedioth Ahronot this morning, I'm not sure if it's coming out in English, but really he kind of laid out how the dilemma. And how at the end of the day, though, we can't lose sight of the larger objective, which is the elimination as much as possible of Hamas. And at some point, the government's going to have to say enough. We have to go back to getting the job done. And I don't think anyone can argue with the fact that the military pressure is what has been instrumental in getting Hamas to also release some of the hostages, at least for now. Right? Hamas's strategy, I thought, was when they took these hostages, people have asked me all along throughout this conflict, what were they thinking, right? Were they surprised by their success or is this what they wanted? I think personally, and then I want to hear what you have to say, I think it was a mix. They were a bit surprised. They were surprised how everything collapsed and how much we failed at stopping them. But they wanted to take so many hostages and they thought that with the hostages and because of the division in Israeli society, we would not be responding the way we are. But now, once again, they've been able to stop us by using the hostages. So they take our strength, which is our ability to pay a price, to sacrifice the many for the few. That is a strength, but that's also our weakness at the same time. And they play on that every step along the way. What do you think, Aina?
So I think we're eating the fruit of just our terrible leadership from the beginning, because you get to problems when you don't solve issues ahead of time. So one of the main problems with the leadership is that immediately on October 7th or on October 8th, they did not make it clear what the war is about. And this is also something that still could be corrected. I don't know if with this leadership, but it could still be corrected as Israel basically says, okay, what would the resumption of fighting look like? And Israel, I thought that on the first day, Israel should have closed Gaza completely and laid siege to it and not allow anything to go in and make it clear that Israel is willing. Israel doesn't want to go to war. It's been invaded. 1,200 people have been butchered, but we don't want to go to war. These are the four conditions. Release all the hostages unconditionally, disarm Hamas and destroy the tunnels, give all the perpetrators to justice, and publicly renounce from the river to the sea ideology. And just repeat it very quietly, very calmly, and say, this is it. Nothing goes into Gaza until those things happen. And yes, there would have been pressure, but we would have, I mean, maybe in another world, but a leader that actually knows what we want. Because what we're doing now is the worst of all possible worlds. We are basically bringing in all this stuff into Gaza, which will literally fuel Hamas and fuel the extended conflict. We're not making it clear what our goals are. We're not making it clear that we're willing to end the war tomorrow if those goals are achieved. And those are reasonable goals. The fact that we even listened to your discussion, our military helped, didn't help. We didn't have the kind of leaders who could speak clearly on the first day and say, this is not on us. In no world is the kidnapping of toddlers and children from their beds a way to engage in negotiation. We played into the normalization that, of course, we need to engage in negotiation. Whether or not you think the military maneuver helped or didn't help, at the end of it, you're still assuming that there would be a negotiation. And we used to be a country that didn't do that and actually went and saved people and knew how to handle itself diplomatically and to tell the world, this is what needs to be done. But we did none of that. So when we have such mediocre at best, but really flaccid leadership, then we're stuck with the worst of all worlds. And that's where we are. And I hope that at least someone will rise up to say, we do not want to resume. Say that. We are not interested in resuming hostilities. We do not want war. War is hell. These are the four things that need to happen. If they don't happen, war will resume. But here, if someone can take care of those things, we're happy to go home and take care of our own. But at least have a clarity of purpose, because at the end of the day, the legitimacy for continued fighting cannot rest forever on the butchery of October 7th. We can screen the movie and all that, but it's not going to be backward facing. It has to be forward facing. We need to be clear on what we are trying to achieve. And once we're clear on that, the war can resume tomorrow, the war can resume in 2 months, but at least have a clarity of purpose of what we're trying to achieve.
And that is something that we're not getting from the government. That I totally agree with. We're not getting clarity. We're not getting an understanding of where everything is going and what the objective is, right? And we went from populist terms and slogans, we're going to destroy and eradicate Hamas, to now we want to topple Hamas, and who knows where else that eventually leads to. Well, tonight though, we're at least hopeful. It seems that the negotiations for the release of another 11 hostages will take place, 8 children and 3 women, I guess mothers. And the extension of the ceasefire by another 2 days for another 20 hostages, although I would expect a lot of games by Hamas in the days to come. And these dilemmas will have to be dealt with by this leadership that, as you so eloquently said, Einat, is not exactly that doing that good a job at being as eloquent as a people in a time of crisis, I think, requires. So I want to thank Yonatan, I want to thank Einat, I want to thank Ib Foxman, and I want to thank all of you for joining us this evening. We'll be back tomorrow with another episode of JPPI's Inside Analysis. In the meantime, thank you very much and have a good evening.